They called him an enemy, but clearly a captive fighter, someone who's protected by the Geneva Conventions and our own laws of war. He should have been cared for, and he was by the other SEALs. But what the SEALs say is then Edward Gallagher came over and, without really saying anything, took out a custom knife and stabbed him in the neck and in the torso and killed him.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Dave Phillips. We'll certainly link to your expose in the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, correspondent for the Times. The piece headlined, Navy SEALs were warned against reporting their chief for war crimes. And that does it for our broadcast. I'll be speaking at the University of California, Berkeley, and we'll be showing our film, 4 Days in Occupied Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. That's Saturday at 6 p.m. at the Genetics and Plant Biology Building in Berkeley. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Rose City Chocolate Festival, May 4th and 5th at the Doubletree Hotel by Hilton in the Lloyd District, featuring handcrafted work from local and national chocolate makers, including milk chocolate, dark chocolate, specialty bars, truffles, toffee, and more. Open to the public and family-friendly. Tickets and more information available online at rosecitychocolate.com.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Gathering of the Guilds, Friday, April 26th through 28th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. The Gathering of the Guilds showcases the talents of 5 Oregon artisan guilds: the Creative Metal Arts Guild, Oregon Glass Guild, Guild of Oregon Woodworkers, Portland Bead Society, and Portland Handweavers Guild. More than 150 artisans working in metals, glass, wood, beads, and fibers will be exhibiting their artistic creations, doing demonstrations, offering youth activities, and more during this 3-day artisan show. Again, that's the Gathering of the Guilds, Friday, April 26th through 28th at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you so much for supporting KBOO during our recent spring membership drive.
Thank you.
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 We're really appreciative for all that you do to support your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an Oregon comedian is demanding $250,000 in damages from U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
A bill to reform Oregon's juvenile justice system took one step closer to law yesterday.
And in Afghanistan, a new report says the first 3 months of 2019 saw more civilians killed by U.S. and Afghan forces than by the Taliban.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 25th, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ani. Oregon comedian Mahanad Elshiki has filed an administrative complaint against federal immigration officials for pulling him off a bus in Spokane and detaining him in late January. Elshiki is demanding $250,000 in damages from U.S. Customs and Border Protection for being racially profiled and falsely arrested after a performance in Pullman, Washington. El-Sheikhi was granted asylum in the U.S. in 2018, but he says in the complaint that he was interrogated for 20 minutes by agents who alleged his papers were fake and that he was in the country illegally. The government has 6 months to grant, deny, or negotiate the amount of damages. If there is no resolution, El-Sheikhi could sue in federal court.
Washington County sheriffs showed up at two Islamic Center facilities yesterday in response to concerns of a possible threat. But FBI spokeswoman Beth Ann Steele told the Associated Press today there was no known threat to any Oregon Islamic Center. She said local law enforcement partners increased patrols at some Islamic facilities during the day, but no arrests have been made and that an investigation is ongoing. Bassam Mohammed, an office administrator at the Bilal Masjid Mosque in Beaverton, said Washington County Sheriff's deputies showed up yesterday morning and stayed for several hours. He says police officers also went to an Islamic school and that his children attend there in Tigard. So far, the FBI has not revealed the nature of the threat or how it was resolved.
The Oregon Health Authority is holding a disaster training exercise modeled on an international release of the plague set for April 30th. The 3-day disaster simulation will focus on training emergency responders on rapid distribution of antibiotics. Health officials say the goal of the exercise is to practice quickly getting antibiotics into communities to treat people and prevent the disease's spread. All Oregon counties and tribes will participate. The emergency simulation is called Operation OX, which stands for Oregon Exercise. It's coordinated by the Health Security, Preparedness, and Response Section at the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division. Officials said today that while the potential for Operation OX's scenario is real, the likelihood is low. Plague, a bacterial disease that killed millions of people in Asia and Europe during the Middle Ages, is now treatable with modern antibiotics. However, the disease can cause serious illness or death without prompt treatment.
Daimler Trucks North America has announced that it will make electric Freightliner trucks in Portland. Local production is scheduled to begin on 2021. Daimler says it's building the trucks in Portland to reach the large California market where rigorous air quality standards are increasing demand for zero-emission commercial vehicles. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality also has an aspirational goal for zero automotive emissions by 2050. Daimler says it's already developing electric vehicle technology at its research labs on Swan Island. But previously, the company said it planned to build electric trucks in North Carolina. Daimler did not immediately reveal the cost of Freightliner Factory's conversion to electric vehicle production or whether the change will produce additional jobs.
A coalition is petitioning the Oregon Board of Forestry to put more protections in place for coho salmon. The coalition says logging practices are hurting salmon habitat. KBOO's Janelle Ferretti has the story.
Conservation and fishing groups are calling on Oregon to enact stronger protections for salmon from the effects of logging. 20 groups have petitioned the Oregon Board for Forestry for new rules to prevent logging-related degradations of habitats on state and private timberlands for coho salmon, which are protected as endangered at the state and federal level. Cascadia Wildlands Legal Director Nick Caddy says law requires the board to identify and protect resource sites for endangered species when they conflict with logging, but have never done so for fish. He says that's hurt Oregon water resources.
There's a lot of scientific evidence and information from the EPA and other federal agencies that Oregon has really fallen behind on water quality and water temperature, and it's leading to a lot of outcomes, not just for coho salmon, but for a host of other species and public health as well.
Caddy says Oregon has the weakest productions on private timberlands in the country. The Board of Forestry says water quality in Oregon is so much better than in other states. But Caddy and a coalition of groups behind this petition say the state can do more. He says action on this would provide Oregon a chance to look at how well it is protecting rivers and streams.
The coho salmon petition presents an opportunity to the state of Oregon to comprehensively address all of these issues that are having drastic impacts to water in our state and really take a hard, direct look at it all at once. And so that's what we're hoping they do here.
The petition also identifies road buildings for logging on the Oregon coast as detrimental to coho salmon population. Historically, coho numbers were above 1 million but began a massive drop-off in the 1960s and 70s and averaged only about 30,000 in the 1990s. For the Oregon News Service and KBOO Radio, I'm Janelle.
Orcas in the Salish Sea are starving to death, and the Lummi tribe in northern Washington this week released a live salmon into the water as a spiritual offering to one ailing female killer whale. This week, tribal members took reporters out into the sea to draw attention to their concern that orcas are going extinct. The tribe is specifically worried about the orca named J-17, also known as Princess Angeline, who appears to be starving to death and may not survive through the summer. Her role is important because orcas organize their pods around older females. The ceremony the Lummi performed this week is considered sacred and ordinarily not made public, but the Lummi say they decided to share it with journalists to get the word out about the whale's risk of extinction. Just 75 southern resident killer whales survive in the Salish Sea. That's down from a peak of 200.
On Tuesday, April 16th, 2019, the Oregon Senate voted 20-10 in favor of Senate Bill 1008 that reforms Oregon's juvenile justice system. Karen James spoke this week with Kevin McGee, who was sentenced as an adult at 16 years of age and served almost 6 years under Measure 11, Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing law.
On April 16th, Oregon senators voted 20-10 in support of Senate Bill 1008, a bill that includes measures to update youth sentencing laws. I'm here with Kenneth McGee, who recently released from incarceration. Kenny was convicted of robbery and served 70 months. He was sentenced as an adult when he was 16 years old. Senate Bill 1008 passed the Oregon Senate, as I said, on April 16th, and will soon move to the House, where it needs a two-thirds majority vote to pass. So that's 40 votes to pass this bill to make it law. Kenny McGee, why is this bill so important to juvenile justice?
This bill is important because it gives second looks to people under Measure 11, which creates hope and incentive to do better while they're in there under these long sentences. It also eliminates life without parole sentences for youth, and juveniles wouldn't go straight into the adult system. They'll be placed in a youth correctional facility unless a judge appoints them to the adult system.
Senate Bill 1008 reforms Oregon's mandatory minimum sentencing law, Measure 11, that was passed by Oregonians in 1994. Under Measure 11, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds are prosecuted as adults for certain crimes. The minimum sentence is 5 years and 10 months, and they must serve day for day. Kenny, you were incarcerated under Measure 11 for almost 6 years. What would having a second look have meant to you during your long mandatory minimum sentence?
It would have gave me hope, you know, more of a incentive to want to do well, and I could have been back home with my family.
And you also said that Senate Bill 1008 would make the juvenile system the default placement for youth unless a judge decides otherwise. What would it have meant to you to be sentenced as a juvenile instead of sentenced as an adult?
So the first piece to that is I would have had a chance to serve the time that was necessary instead of the time that's just a minimum flat for anyone. Along with that, once I came home, I wouldn't have had a felony on my adult record. It would have been on my juvenile record, so I would still be able to get a job, go to school, and get housing. We should be focused on mental health. We should be focused on drug treatment, providing more role models or mentors, building a better support system to better our community, instead of giving lengthy sentences and not getting to the root of the problem for youth. We're urging everyone to call your Oregon House reps and urge them to vote yes on Senate Bill 1008. You can go to OregonLegislature.gov to contact your legislators.
Tune in to KBOO Evening News on Monday evening to hear more from Kenny McGee and why we should urge a yes vote on Senate Bill 1008. For KBOO News, I'm Karen James.
The city of Lake Oswego is famous for its racism, in part thanks to a certain joke about how some people say the words. But over the past 2 years, Lake Oswego residents have stepped up to address the racism in their town. This project is called Respond to Racism, and live tonight we have its media action team leader, Bruce Poinsett. Thanks for joining us tonight, Bruce.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so first off, let's find out exactly what Respond to Racism is. What do you do?
Well, we're a grassroots volunteer organization where our focus is really educating and empowering people in LO with, I guess we'd say, the tools to combat racism in its various forms.
Now, is part of that educating them about the racism that may exist in their town that they may not be aware of?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So what incident, if there was one specifically, prompted you to start this organization?
Yeah, it started with it started following a road rage incident with a man named Nathan Shepard, who basically got into an incident with a white man in LO who, you know, they pulled over. He, you know, shouted a bunch of racial slurs at him in front of, ironically, the man did this in front of, while his children were there too.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. This is crazy. But Nathan Shepard was also a detective. Went on to write a blog post about it that got a lot of people talking, and on, you know, the social media app Nextdoor, basically, like, the conversation spilled over to there, and you had sort of the typical response that happens with this, where a lot of people say, oh, you're just, don't say that, you're making our town look bad, it's really not that bad. And a number of people, including my mother, Willie Poinsett, and Liberty Miller, who are the co-founders of this organization, were, you know, trying to have more conversation. And basically Liberty invited people out to, you know, have this in person, and the only person who showed up was my mother. But, you know,
now, gotta have mom to support you.
Yeah. So, you know, on one hand you have, you know, this white non-binary person, and then younger person, then you have my mother, who's, you know, grew up during the civil rights era in South Carolina. So they're coming from two very, you know, different perspectives. But they decided from that conversation that they wanted to try it again. And then, you know, they reached out to Lake Oswego United Church of Christ, who I just want to give a big shout out to, because they did a lot of work. They created the foundation for this. And they held another meeting, and 60 people showed up. And it's kind of been, ever since then, it's really kind of kicked off. Now we have our monthly community meetings, and we get about 75 to 100 people. So,
wow, that's wonderful to hear. So, you know, Portland is kind of known, and Oregon is somewhat known as being having very racist origins. But is Lake Oswego more racist than other Oregon towns? Is there more racism there?
I don't know if I would say there's more. I would say the real issue is that, like Oregon, it's just very pervasive and casual. It's And I think with LO especially, like, it has many nicknames. Obviously, everyone knows Lake No Negro, but another one that people in town, I guess, like a little bit more is the bubble. But I think the flip side of that is, or not even the flip side, but the thing about that is people are so insulated that they're not really challenged on a lot of this casual racism. And some of that is, you know, things like microaggressions, but other things is, like, you're talking about casual use of the N-word by white people. That, you know, we recently held a student panel in which, you know, we had students talking about that, and it was interesting to see a lot of the adults in the room who you could tell, like, this is their first time really hearing these perspectives, or really, even though this town has such a reputation, which is always weird to me because it's like, doesn't everyone know about this? But, you know, when you hear it from, especially, like, young people straight from the source, it just has that different effect. So, like I said, I wouldn't say it's any more racist than any other place I've lived in Oregon, but Oregon in general is actually very racist. So,
and a lot of people would be surprised to hear that, considering that we're considered such a progressive area of the country, but that is the case. So you talked a little bit about how the organization has grown. Can you tell us about some events you have going on in Lake Oswego and in other towns around the area?
Yeah. So, like I said, our big, our flagship event is our monthly community meetings, where we usually, you know, sometimes it'll be around, like, a specific subject, like if something has happened in the community, people respond. And then we also include breakout sessions where people can go into either one of three groups, which is a learning, action, and dialogue. And, you know, the learning group will usually be something to basically expand upon the first part of our meeting, which, you know, if it's like a certain topic, like, I don't know, let's just use microaggressions again, it'll be sort of a deeper dive into that. Or we'll have dialogue where, you know, people can just kind of share their stories, and it's more, as opposed to like a learning lecture style, it's more just people sharing stories and getting different perspectives. And then we have our action group, which does more to, you know, like organize and talk about like things we can actually get done and try and, you know, do in the community. So we also have like an event coming up on the 29th is our school board candidate forum, in which, you know, we're trying to really just, I guess, make sure we're influencing and making sure these subjects and these issues, specifically, you know, I hate using the buzzwords sometimes, but diversity, equity, and inclusion are at the forefront of the discussion. And a thing like school board, it's so important. So we're doing that as well. See other events. We've just we're trying to do more partnerships with other, you know, likewise organizations. We recently did a talk with State Senator Rob Wagner, with in partnership with the Westland Alliance for Inclusive Communities and Mary's Woods Retirement Center, where we got to explore the new our Holocaust and Genocide Education Bill and the Suicide Prevention Bill, and, you know, give basically community members in both Lake Oswego and Westland the opportunity to learn more about it, ask questions, present concerns. And also, you know, a lot of these bills, part of it, the first part is obviously the legislation itself, but a lot of it comes from like how the people move with it, like how the, basically like however the community decides to use this as a tool can determine how effective it is or isn't. So
it sounds like it's a pretty interesting trajectory. You can go to one of your events and there's information, there's education, and then there is an activism portion to it as well. Now, can people who don't live in Lake Oswego or West Lynn come out to your events? Do you have people coming from like Oregon City and other Clackamas County areas?
Yeah, we absolutely. We definitely invite people from, you know, outside of LO and West Lynn and, you know, the surrounding areas to come. We've had I think recently when we did our student panel, actually, we had a bunch of people come in from Portland just because, you know, it was something that hadn't really been done in LO before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah, we invite people, we invite, you know, organizations that are doing sort of, you know, similarly along the lines of, I guess, community education. Like, we're always looking for, you know, opportunities for partnerships and to really just, I guess the best way I could put it is sort of like break down these artificial barriers. You know, like, as I'll just quickly say, as like a Black person who grew up in Lake Oswego, I quickly realized that keeping myself, you know, insulated into the community wasn't actually to my benefit, and that, you know, taking on some of these sort of like, you know, school and tribalistic affiliations almost, it's not helpful. It's not like it's great for the people if you're in the majority, like you don't have to think about it, but if you're, you know, an isolated person, you're looking for as much connection as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to switch gears a little bit here. Lake Oswego just appointed an equity task force. How's that going? Do you know what's happening with that, and are you participating in it?
Well, technically, I can't participate in the actual task force because I am technically not a resident. I'm involved in the community, but I live in Tigard. But, you know, I've been involved in terms of like the beginning of just the conversations around it and getting it, trying to get it, you know, off the ground as much as possible. They recently just had a meeting. So yeah, I can talk about how on one hand it's, you know, encouraging because, you know, it's not something that's been there before. And if, especially if you're looking for, you know, if we're trying to, I guess, increase the diversity of the town, making sure you have like institutions that are actually trying to like speak for people's needs, especially needs that haven't been spoken for really historically, having that there is important. At the same time, though, I think my concern is definitely making sure it's not just a box checking exercise. Right. You know, like saying, okay, we have this in our town, so we look good, as opposed to saying we're trying to move the needle for marginalized people in the community. So, you know, right now the process, they're still forming it. They're, you know, looking into like how they're going to go about the selection process. And my thing that my message that I would say to the community and any, you know, concerned people is to make sure you, you know, let your voices be heard. Let people know that we want to have as many different, you know, perspectives of marginalized people represented on this board as possible. Make sure that we want it to be effective, that we want to actually, you know, get people's really address people's needs, as opposed to just saying, you know, we have X here, Y here, Z here, you know. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned your mom was a very early adopter and a part of your organization, a key part of your organization, and she won an important civic award for this kind of work. Who honored her, and can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, she recently won the Community Leader of the Year Award from the Lake Oswego Chamber of Commerce. And, you know, I mean, obviously I'm a proud son. And
of course.
You know, long
following
long
in her
overdue.
Footsteps, really.
Something like that, I guess. But, you know, I think it was, you know, just for starting this organization, for just being like, because she does, you know, people see her as like the face of the organization at the head of the meetings, but she's also doing all this work behind the scenes, meeting with people from various, you know, different like positions of influence or just community members, students, being that supportive voice and doing like not just the administrative stuff, but also, you know, all the things. Just all the little things that, you know, you don't think about, all the little personable things, and just really just showing how to not just be a leader, but be like a leading with compassion, you know.
Right. Interacting with people one-on-one, it's such an important skill.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what was really great about when she received that award is that she really seized the moment, because, you know, you get had a little time to give remarks and people are usually like, you know, thank you for this award. But, you know, we're in this, you know, at this fancy golf course. I was joking with people, like, it reminded me of, you know, like the Bruce Wayne's mansion from Batman or something. And I was just waiting for the Joker to come in and just like bust in the party. But, you know, so she took the time to say, like, you know, you see so little people of color in this room right now. There's so little engagement for it was so powerful when she says, talking about just feeling invisible for so long, despite living in LO for 32 years. And she really challenged the people in that room, whether it's the chamber, whether it's the city, just community members, anyone who was watching at the moment or watching or would be watching later, to do more, to be more intentional, to be, you know, to really push themselves. Because, like, you look at this room, or you look at that room, you look at, you know, just all these dynamics, we can do so much more.
Well, on that note, we just have a few seconds, and I want to make sure that people know how to get involved with Respond to Racism, and also one more time about your school board candidate forum that is happening on Monday night, the 29th. Is that correct?
Correct.
Give us the time and the place of that.
Yes, the school board candidate forum is from 6:30 to 8 at Lake Oswego United Church of Christ. Doors open at 6. And in terms of getting involved with Respond, you could, one, follow us on our website, respondtoracism.org, and that's where we have information for all of our events, as well as original content such as our storytelling project, which highlights the voices, especially of like people of color in the community, and also a weekly column, This Week's Five, where we offer, you know, information on different types of racism, such as, you know, institutional, overt. Offer articles on critical race theory, history, and then a little something I call the fragility breaker, which we don't have time to get into now, but it's like a little sensory experience. And if you also want to get involved, if you're in, you know, in the LO community, you know, please reach out to, you know, hit us up by email. You can volunteer with us. Basically, what we're able to do is a reflection of our capacities.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Bruce. That was Bruce Poinsett of Respond to Racism. You can find out more about them online at respondtoracism.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on...
An in-depth report on... actually infertility.
There we go.
Infertility.
All right. That's going to happen. And at 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, it's the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, it's going to be clear with lows around 48 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny and 64 degrees. Today in history, Ella Jane Fitzgerald was born in 1917 in Newport News, Virginia. She was one of the leading jazz singers of all time. In her lifetime, she won 13 Grammys, two from the first Grammy Awards in 1958. Her recordings have sold more than 40 million albums. And the quote of the day is from Ella Fitzgerald, who said, "It isn't where you came from, it's where you're going that counts."
The Supreme Court of the United States has announced that they will consider the question of whether citizenship status will be included on the 2020 census. Some analysts believe the Supreme Court will support the addition of the question, "Are you a citizen?" This despite warnings from representatives of the U.S. Census Bureau, who say it will lead to drastic undercounts of U.S. populations in certain areas of the country that have large immigrant populations. The question has not been included since the 1950s, when it was withdrawn because of the undercount problem. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who was appointed by Trump, has led the campaign to add the citizenship question to the census. He has been accused of violating numerous ethics rules in his push to add this question to the census. The Supreme Court heard the Trump administration's arguments on the census question on Tuesday and will likely issue a ruling in June.
Former Vice President Joseph R. Biden Jr. has called Anita Hill to express his regret over what she endured while testifying against Justice Clarence Thomas in 1991. Biden officially declared his candidacy for presidency today, but it's widely thought that one of his biggest weaknesses centers on how sexist that hearing was, as well as a growing number of women alleging that he touched them inappropriately in recent years. The Thomas confirmation hearings put a spotlight on sexual harassment of women, but despite Hill's testimony, Thomas was given a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. Biden was chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee when Hill's credibility was questioned. Hill said yesterday, after a meeting with Biden earlier this month, that he didn't really apologize to her and that she will not support his candidacy. Hill said yesterday, and I quote, "The focus on apology to me is one thing, but he needs to give an apology to the other women and to the American public, because we know now how deeply disappointed Americans around the country were about what they saw. And not just women. There are women and men now who have really lost confidence in the ability of our government to respond to the problem of gender violence."
A new rule proposed by the Trump administration would rescind civil rights protections for transgender Americans. Those were established under the Obama administration. The non-discrimination protections were created by the Affordable Care Act and required that trans people be provided with access to medical care, such as hormone therapy and surgical procedures. Advocates of these civil rights protections say that rescinding them would be devastating to America's trans community and would create a medical system that is objectively hostile to the LGBTQ community. The Department of Health and Human Resources has not officially supported the Trump administration move, but they have supported lawsuits challenging the Obama-era protections.
An invasive grass called phragmites can grow so dense, turtles can't get through it to lay their eggs. Now it's time for Current Cast with David Sweetnam.
Pulling phragmites in Georgian Bay. On this Current Cast. Wetlands in Ontario's Georgian Bay are threatened by an invasive grass called phragmites that outcompetes many native species.
It actually can grow to about 18 feet tall and displace native plants from their aquatic habitat.
That's David Sweetnam of the nonprofit Georgian Bay Forever. He says in some areas, there are hundreds of phragmites plants per square meter.
You have species that go between the water and the land, like turtles, to lay their eggs. They can't physically get through the stands of phragmites.
So Sweetnam's group is training volunteers to identify and remove the invasive plants by hand. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more at currentcast.org.
Facts are we going to talk about?
Happy Chucky Feet the Penguin film? Is there a sequel? There are just a couple of...
A new study published today in Nature Communications has revealed that greenhouse gases escaping from thawing Arctic permafrost have the potential to add up to $70 trillion to the global climate bill. The study says that countries need to improve on commitments made in the Paris Climate Agreement in order to avoid a near 5% amplification of costs associated with global warming. As the permafrost melts, gases are being released from organic material which has been trapped on ice for several hundred years. The authors of the study say they are the first to calculate the economic impact of a melting Arctic.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick, in for Antonio Gonzalez. After several years of improvement, Montana's Native American graduation rate dropped slightly last year. That's according to Montana's new statewide school report card released this week. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien reports.
The Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA for short, is the federal replacement for No Child Left Behind. Data from the last school year in the ESSA report shows 68% of Native students graduated within 4 years. That's down a point and a half from the prior year. Last year, the graduation rate for white students was 21 points higher than for Natives and improved by 0.3%. The drop in the Native American graduation rate comes after 5 years of growth, including a 3.5% spike in 2017. Overall, results in the statewide ESSA report card are a mixed bag.
That tells us aggregately that we can do better.
Elsie Arnson is Montana's state superintendent of public instruction.
But I know there are moments where we need to celebrate success as much as what it is that we can do better. Let's go ahead and put more emphasis on those ones that are almost there so we can carry them over the finish line. That's a success story that's going to be told next year when this report card goes out again.
Montana's ESSA plan calls for students who have historically scored the lowest in tests, students from poor families, English learners, kids with disabilities, and Native Americans to show the greatest academic improvement over the next several years.
That was Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien. A new advisory committee on Bears Ears National Monument in southern Utah is drawing flack from supporters of the monument, including Native Americans. The Salt Lake Tribune reports among the 15 people on the committee that will provide guidance on managing the reserve, there's no one who supported the original designation of the monument in 2016. However, there are plenty of opponents to the monument designation. Only two committee members are part of Native American tribes who consider the land to be sacred. Ryan Benally is a member of the Navajo Nation. He opposed the monument designation. He told the Deseret News in 2017 it hurts tribal communities. Alfred Ben is vice president of the Aneth chapter of the Navajo Nation. He also opposed the monument designation. In a 2017 opinion piece for The Hill, Ben wrote that his community would like to see lasting protections for the area rather than a presidential proclamation, and he argued only Congress can pass laws to do that. Gavin Noyes is executive director of Utah Dene Bekea. The tribal group developed the proposal that led to the monument's designation. He said other candidates with more expertise, such as his board member, Jonah Yellowman, were overlooked because they support the monument. President Barack Obama's proclamation creating the monument states the advisory committee should reflect a, quote, fair and balanced representation of interested stakeholders. The U.S. Navy and other officials will soon repatriate remains taken from the San Nicolas Island to at least four California tribes. The Ventura County Star reports excavations over more than a century sent artifacts and remains to museums and other collections. The federal government has been working with tribes since 2012 to identify, consolidate, and return all the items taken from the island, which the Navy now owns and manages. The tribes intend to return the remains to the island. Mark Macaro, chairman of the Pechanga Band of Luseño Indians, previously told the governor that the remains of their ancestors deserve the dignity of being reinterred and cared for under tribal custom and tradition. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Vladimir Putin met today in Vladivostok to discuss Pyongyang's nuclear program. The summit is the first between Putin and Kim. Russia has long been involved in efforts to persuade North Korea to give up its nuclear program. South Korea's foreign ministry said, quote, "Russia shares our viewpoints, such as the achievement of complete denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula and the settlement of permanent peace." According to South Korea's foreign ministry, the summit agenda will include Russian-North Korea relations, denuclearization, and regional cooperation.
According to a new report by the United Nations, in the first 3 months of 2019, more civilians were killed by U.S. and Afghan forces in Afghanistan than by the Taliban. This marks the first time in over a decade that a majority of civilian deaths in a given period were caused by U.S. and Afghan military forces, not the Taliban. 581 civilians were killed during the three-month time period. Though the number of deaths was a significant decrease from the same time period in 2018, the UN reports that U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan have increased civilian airstrike deaths and injuries significantly. In the first 2 months of 2019, the United States dropped over 790 bombs on the country. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 25th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emily Gresham Beamer, Janelle Ferretti, and Annette Newell. Our engineer is Randall Rago. The Interim Director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ani.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is National Infertility Awareness Week. Haley Nye and Kristen Cornett are the owners of a local small business called Tiny Feet, and their goal is to provide alternatives for local families trying to have babies. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with them about how fertility issues impact non-binary families and alternatives to in vitro fertilization.
At Tiny Feet, we help couples prepare for pregnancy and reclaim their fertility if they're currently struggling with getting pregnant. So we started Tiny Feet with this idea last year in 2018 of creating an online fertility assessment where couples can actually go on and answer about 50 to 100 questions, depending on what kind of questions or answers that they have. And it will give them an individualized assessment based off of their answers in four different categories, which is medical, nutrition, lifestyle, and environmental exposures. And so that was our first product. And then we also are creating additional products in as far as like online courses for couples. And then we work one-on-one with them with functional lab testing and nutritional supplements and nutritional therapy.
We've had an amazing time just creating the assessment. Like Haley mentioned, that was our first product, but we really wanted to make sure that we were able to really bring our expertise to the table and offer something that was a little bit more one-on-one, and that's where kind of the functional labs come in. And this is something that's actually given us quite a bit of success on our own health journeys, because we've had some health issues and some fertility struggles ourselves, and we found a lot of healing and a lot of success with these functional medicine approaches. And so we wanted to bring that in with our clients as well and be able to use that in addition to the online products that we have.
I wanted to ask you about that, because as I was reading about your work, you were looking at alternatives to just in vitro fertilization, like what more is out there. Why is your work important? How is it impacting people's families?
That's a great question. I think one of the biggest things, and one of the misconceptions I think about this type of work, is that it's either or. It's either in vitro fertilization or it's a more functional and integrative approach. And we don't necessarily believe that. I mean, this can be an alternative, especially for women who don't have access to in vitro fertilization, because not everybody does have access to IVF. And there are other reasons, such as cost or just the physical and emotional burden that IVF can bring, that may kind of discourage a couple from pursuing that. But it's also important to remember that the work that we do is geared at improving a couple's overall health. And that can actually radically increase their success rates if they do choose to go through IVF. So we could be an alternative, or we could also be an integrative approach that works with IVF to help couples be successful with that.
Talk about that a little bit. That's what made me so interested in your material. You were talking about literally how to make yourself as healthy as you can.
Yeah, so the one thing that really got me to become passionate about this particular field of medicine is learning about preconception care. And I learned about this in medical school, actually, at a lecture at OHSU originally, and how preconception care prepares the body optimally for pregnancy and actually reduces the risk of chronic conditions in our future generations. And because of that, I thought, oh my gosh, all women need to know about this. They need to understand that there's new and upcoming research out there in regards to nutrient repletion, making sure that they are eating the right diet and balancing their blood sugars, and how all of that actually increases their ability to get pregnant, but also increases the chance of them having a healthy child.
We've touched on this a bit, but what are the major obstacles that your clients face? All of them, because we're talking about women, but we're talking about men. And then we have a lot of people in our community that are non-gender binary also trying to have babies. So what are some of the obstacles that your clients face?
I think one of the biggest obstacles, especially for the non-binary genders, is that they need to find a doctor that is going to understand their situation, understand, you know, they need to get sperm donor, and they want to make sure that they get a healthy sperm donor, right? We've had questions like that from our clients and patients. And they also need to find somebody who's going to work with their biology and not just force their biology. A lot of times they say, oh, you want to get pregnant? Okay, here's Clomid, here's letrozole. We're going to start stimulations right away, and then we're going to either do egg retrieval or we're going to do IUI, which is the intrauterine insemination. And oftentimes it could be very expensive, and there's other options. And I think that's something really important that people need to know.
Yeah, I think another obstacle is that even for all couples or anybody who's trying to get pregnant is finding a healthcare provider that believes that there are underlying health issues that need to be addressed when people want to get pregnant. And, you know, for instance, we see when we do live webinars, or, you know, we reach out to our email list and say, hey, you know, tell us what you're struggling with right now. Talk to us about what you want to know more about. And they're asking us questions about how to get their doctors on board with some of the testing that they want to do. Take thyroid, for example. It's really important to optimize thyroid health before trying to get pregnant. And you need to do a full panel, you know, not just testing the TSH. And women are having a hard time getting their doctors just to do a full thyroid panel, to fully investigate that, to rule it out as an issue, or to make sure that it's not going to become one as they go forward. Testing for vitamin D, it's such an easy and inexpensive test. A lot of doctors don't believe that's important. There's a huge pile of research to suggest that that is an extremely important nutrient to optimize before getting pregnant, not just for fertility, but for reducing the risk of miscarriage and reducing the risk of immune system dysfunction and even autism in kids. And so the ability to get the kind of care that these women and couples are asking for is a little bit of an obstacle, because doctors aren't necessarily reading all of the latest research. A lot of it's new. And it takes, I think the statistic is 17 years for new research to actually make it into clinical practice and change recommendations that doctors are making to their patients.
Who is most likely to seek out your services?
That's a good question. I think we appeal to kind of a wide audience. I think to some degree, because of the fact that we have this fertility assessment product, there are a lot of people that are just interested in creating a better environment in their bodies, like just doing preconception care. And so that's kind of one piece of the audience, people that really just want to make sure that they're healthy before they get pregnant. There's another part of the audience that are people who are struggling, and they're struggling specifically with chronic health conditions and or chronic symptoms that are unexplained and that aren't being investigated in the context of their fertility care. So, you know, digestive issues, that's a really big one that we see. Gut health has a huge impact on fertility. I know that's surprising. I can see your face right now, like, what? But it really does. And that's actually a big part of my personal story, is the way that gut health influences how well we're able to absorb nutrients. 80% of your immune system is in your gut. So whether or not you have high levels of inflammation in your body, which affects egg quality, that's dependent on gut health. So we talk a lot about digestive wellness in our practice and on our podcast. We have a podcast called Mastering Your Fertility. We address things like inflammation. I think Haley already mentioned blood sugar balance and hormone balance, all of those things. And so it's this whole idea of creating functional wellness in the body that lends itself to optimal fertility, because that's really what fertility is. It's a reflection of how healthy you are as a person.
Physically healthy.
Right.
Can you give a brief history of infertility treatments? How have they evolved maybe over the past 10 years?
Yeah, so I'll give you a brief history. I believe the first IVF success, like test tube baby, was in the early 1970s. And over time is increased to about 75,000 children are born to IVF each year. And really, because of the increase in fertility technology and the ability to freeze your eggs now, and companies are covering that it's becoming more and more popular for women, especially as they get older, right? A lot of us are focusing on career first before we decide to have children. And so we're starting to have children in our late 30s. And at that time, our fertility is declining. And what we're hearing out there is that IVF really is our only option. And so I believe it's becoming more and more popular. It's really a multi-billion dollar industry at this point.
If someone's listening to us right now, how do they access your wisdom? What do they do? How does it work?
Yeah, so one of the first things that they can do is visit our website at tinyfeet.co, and they have a couple options from there. They can either pursue the fertility assessment, which is something that's done completely online. They can easily sign up for that and start answering questions right away. It's $97 to get all of that information in all four of those categories that Dr. Haley just mentioned: nutrition, medical, lifestyle, and environmental exposure. So that's one option. Another option for working with us one-on-one is that we actually offer the ability to order lab tests online. We ship those kits to you. The first two that we start out with are actually a stool test, because gut health is so important, and then also a food sensitivity test, because that's really important to uncovering sources of inflammation in the body. And then along with those two tests, we offer one-on-one consults. So it's a total of 2 hours of our time broken up into two appointments. So we go over the labs, we address all of the findings from those labs, and we create an individualized protocol that includes advice about diet, labs to request from their doctor if there's like blood work that needs to be done, and then also supplements and whatever we need to do basically to address the findings that we see on those labs.
And you're both medical professionals, right? Can you just tell me really quickly, what are your credentials? Because I saw the letters down there and I didn't know what they were, and that sounds silly, but I had to ask you.
That's a really good question. So this is Haley again. So I'm a naturopathic doctor, and I graduated from the National University of Natural Medicine. And I also, while I was there, completed a degree in Master's of Science in Nutrition. So those are my two degrees. And then I actually finished my bachelor's at Portland State University in Health Sciences as well.
Yeah, so this is Kristen. I'm a certified nutritional therapy practitioner through the Nutritional Therapy Association. My background's a little different. I actually didn't start out in healthcare or really even science. I have an undergraduate degree in English and a master's of business administration from Portland State University, and I worked in corporate finance. And when my health started to kind of fail is when I discovered nutrition and functional medicine, found a lot of healing, and then got really passionate about sharing that with others. So I decided to pursue my nutrition certification while I was still working as an analyst. And then I quit my job when I finished my degree, and then I met Haley.
What are some of the myths about fertility and infertility? I bet you deal with a lot of them.
Yeah, so one of the biggest myths that we're struggling with right now is a lot of women are coming off of birth control in order to get pregnant. and they feel like they can just get pregnant right away. And with the research, it's showing that that's not necessarily the case. And so there's kind of a movement right now as far as it comes to coming off of birth control and how to rebalance your body to optimize your body before pregnancy. It's really important. And the research is showing that you really should wait at least 6 months after coming off of birth control in order to before you start trying to conceive. I think another big myth is that women think that if they're having struggling conceiving, that it's just them, that it's, you know, it's their female body, it's their uterus, it's their ovaries, something's wrong with them. And that's just completely not the case. 30% of infertility cases is solely just your male partner. And another 30% is a contribution of both your male partner and you need to address both. And so that's one of the biggest reasons why we created the fertility assessment, is because it does address both partners. We have a questionnaire for not only the women, but also for the male partner.
Yeah, 50% of the DNA for a baby comes from the male partner and comes from the quality of that sperm. So I think that is probably one of the biggest strengths of the work that we're doing, is that we do include concrete advice for what men can do to optimize their contribution to their child, because it is really important. And there's just as much evidence to suggest that sperm quality affects long-term health in children just as much as the woman's health before pregnancy.
Okay, my last question. What's the most important thing that you want our listeners to know about your work?
I think for me, I think the most important thing that they need to know is that, you know, I like to come up with this, I have this analogy, is that women, we like to plan our weddings, right? We get engaged, and then we spend about a year or a year and a half planning this beautiful wedding, and we spend thousands of dollars on this one day, and it's just the most beautiful day in our life. But then the next step is we're planning for a baby, and I want couples to know that you need to spend time planning for this baby. Put the effort in, have a clean diet, get the crap out of your house. Don't expose yourselves to exogenous hormones that could actually affect your baby and the health of that baby long term. It really should be like planning a wedding. You know, put the money into it, take the right supplements, get the testing done, and prepare your body so you have a successful pregnancy, but you also have a healthy baby.
Fantastic advice. I think my biggest piece of advice, coming more in my personal journey from the infertility perspective, is to trust your body. You know, if you feel instinctively that something is wrong, investigate it. And if your doctor isn't doing that for you, it's okay to seek out somebody else. It's okay to seek out another healthcare professional. Your concerns are valid, and you should be taken seriously by anybody who's going to treat you for any kind of condition. So I just encourage you to listen to your body, trust yourself, know when something is wrong, and know that it's okay to seek out a different kind of help.
Haley Nye and Kristen Cornett, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you for having us.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:57. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 37th Annual Oregon Ceramic Showcase, Friday, April 26th through the 28th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Oregon Potters Association 37th Annual Ceramic Showcase and Sale features work by over 150 Oregon Potters Association members. It is one of the largest all-ceramic artist shows in the country. The showcase features sculptures, wall art, jewelry, tiles, functional pottery, and more. Again, that's the Oregon Ceramic Showcase, Friday, April 26th through the 28th at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is looked up to very much by people all over the country. Please join us on Saturday, April 27th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. for the KBOO Edit-A-Thon. The Edit-A-Thon helps us add missing information to the KBOO Archives Memory Bank. We need KBOO former volunteers, current volunteers, and listeners to identify content and programs of our historical archive. We'll be dealing with old audio, program guides, and more.
Was attracted by the story.
This event is open to the public. Again, that's the second KBOO Edit-A-Thon on Saturday, April 27th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. here at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland.
And there was a great deal of commotion regarding this event.
More information can be found at kboo.fm/editathon2019.
You are listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize. This is Rose City Native Radio.
Can you tell the Indian first then?
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government, offering new master's degree in nonprofit leadership for those who believe in the power of collective action for social change. More information online at pdx.edu/Hatfield School. Hello, hello. How you doing, Indian Country? This is Rose City Native Radio. I'm your host, Jack Malmstrom, and as always, we have music, fun, and more for you today. Starting off the show here, we're going to start off with a little Tribe Called Red featuring Helen Back with the People's Champ here on KBOO Portland.